This is Expat Experts.
Welcome to this episode of Expat Experts. Today, actually, we're recording from Berlin. Two guests. One will talk, the other
will be very
probably also at some point. Actually, we're recording with Parimal here, already known in the podcast, actually, like from when it was called The Auslander, born in Nepal, grown up in France, studied in USA, currently living in Berlin. I think we covered majority of that in the previous episode. UX UI designer, open project, writer, a little bit of man of renaissance, let's say like this.
I'll gladly take it.
You study languages as hobby, you do music, you ride bikes, you have aviation science, small web, data privacy, a lot of stuff going around, I suppose.
Yeah. A lack of focus, it sounds like.
Also, I know about that. And then cuisine, which is probably what we will talk later in today's episode. For all of the people who are listening to us, just please remember to follow us onto our social media, Instagrams, TikToks, YouTubes, wherever that comes, especially in Spotify and YouTube, follow the channel because that helps. And of course, it's the only way of listening and viewing actually from now on also in Spotify, as they introduce this option to upload video in Spotify also directly. So you can see the episodes, not only listen to them. Let's go for it.
Let's go for it. Let's start.
The Expat, Episode 1 with Parimal Satyal.
So, just before starting, I would just recommend to everyone who is listening to this episode that maybe goes to the episode number 10 of used to be The Auslander, which was the first episode that we recorded together.
We did.
And actually in there we covered everything until arriving here in Berlin.
Right, that's the pre-Berlin show.
So we talk about you, of course, being born in Nepal, but then growing up in France, studying in the United States, US. At some point deciding to move here, but actually at that very point of time, that was pretty recent, the move to Berlin.
Yeah, I suppose it had been... I don't remember exactly when we did it, but a couple of months after, I think. It was fairly recent. Yeah, I didn't know very much about Berlin as someone who had lived there at the time.
Yeah. And now it's already nearly, more than 3 years, actually.
Yeah, over 3 years. Cheers.
Cheers.
It's a nice Bordeaux from 2019. Yeah. So I moved in, I suppose, in April. So it's almost 3 years rather. And it's been quite a ride in the sense of a lot of it is exactly what I expected, and some of it is definitely not what I expected.
Okay.
And I imagine that we'll go into that in a bit. Yeah.
We will definitely go into it. In that sense, like the city didn't match the expectations that you had, at least not completely, as far as I understand. Or you were, because at the end you came here.
Yeah.
Not for pleasure 100%, but you came here because you, like me, we work from home at the end or remotely, so we had the opportunity to have this flexibility in our side. And
indeed,
you didn't came here because you needed to come to
Berlin. Yeah, you're right, I didn't need to come to Berlin. I had two main reasons to come to Berlin. So the first one would be, well, it was to learn German, or I already spoke some German. It would be to improve my German. Mm-hmm. If you want to go to Germany to improve your German, I think any other city would probably be better than Berlin for that. Yeah. But I mean, I did make some progress. That's obviously there. The second reason was because I had lived in Paris for so long that I was afraid that if I don't move somewhere if I don't even try to move somewhere, that I will always regret not moving, and that I will just sort of be stuck in a city.
Okay.
That it'll be by default and not a choice. And Berlin was the obvious choice because my friends, a lot of my friends, including my friends from France, were and are in Berlin, including in this flat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. But one of the things that you were talking about, and what's probably the main reason, was language.
Yeah.
In a city where clearly it's losing its German more and more progressively, especially in the center of the city.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as you go a little bit out of what we will call like the most posh or hipster areas of the city, you can start listening more and more German there. But at the end, if you go to any bar and any restaurant or any service, it's English what we hear the most.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's almost two parallel worlds in Berlin. You can, if you want to, live in a completely English world. I don't want that, so I try to stay away from that.
Mm.
However, imagine if you're a group of friends and you're all sort of international. If there's one person who doesn't speak German, then because people can speak, generally people can speak English, or at least the people around me, we tend to gravitate towards the most common optimal language, or the most optimal common language, which is English. There's that, but that's at a sort of personal level between friends. And then there's the other side that you mentioned, that you go to a bar or a restaurant, and it's already happened to me that I order in German and say, ja, Entschuldigung, dürfen wir was haben oder sowas? And the person says, do you mind? Do you mind speaking in English? I don't speak German.
Mm.
So, but that's one world. And there's the other world, which is more sort of people who are German, who are from Berlin. And there, in certain areas, you can still hear the Berlin dialect. It's not that common, but you can. And I'm always happy to find out, sort of seek out those areas. And in those areas, you have to speak German, which is brilliant. Yeah,
it's how it is in a lot of other cities in Germany. I assume that at the end, you even like learn the dialect of that region and not the academical German at the end.
As you did in Hessen.
More or less. Frankfurt is one of these other cities that if you want, you can also live in an English world. Of
like
course.
A bubble, yeah.
It's
yeah.
But it's what you say. It's literally a bubble of like certain people. And if you want, you can live all your life, of course, in that. And then rely on the friends who speak German to call for whatever you need, if you need something that they don't speak.
The administration.
Administration, yeah. That's the biggest one. Yeah.
That's the classic one, yeah.
Well, with that said, at the end, like we were talking already a little bit of areas of the city, what it's from now, like from these years of experience, your favorite part of Berlin?
Oh yeah, that's a very tough question, because as your listeners and your viewers now might know, there's a lot of the different areas of Berlin have their own charm, or their own sort of personality. Yeah. I would argue that I like where we are in Friedrichshain. We're in Friedrichshain, sort of not in, right near Prenzlauer Berg. It's calm, it's residential, you have lovely wine bars, which is a very important detail for me. But then if you go to other places, like if you go to Mitte, I always avoided Mitte because I had this image that it's a very sort of touristy area. But there also you've got some lovely restaurants and lovely bars. Mm. You're starting to see a theme here. But my favorite area would actually, I would argue, not be an area at all. Which is a very unfair way to answer the question, but I'll do it anyway.
Sure.
Which is, if you like cycling, it's very easy to go out of the city and have access to sort of Brandenburg, the region next to Berlin, or surrounding Berlin, very, very quickly. So you can go even, for example, to Poland on your bike very, very easily. And that ability to be in nature so quickly with infrastructure that I would argue is very well developed is probably my favorite place in Berlin.
Yeah. I see. Yeah. At the end, here it mixes now, and it shows a little bit that your hobbies actually fit more or less in this city. But at the same time, you are saying that some expectations were not met in here. Like, what is the negative part of how are you seeing here?
Yeah, I suppose I wouldn't quite say the expectations weren't met. I would say that I didn't have very clear expectations. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can find everything in Berlin. You can find any niche, any sort of interest has its place in a city like Berlin. I suppose for me, that what I am not a big fan of is the fact that it relates to what we're going to talk about later, which is the food culture. You can find amazing food in Berlin. And there's great street food. If I had to sort of pick different types of food, we go from home cooking and then you go to street food. This food you make, like a medium, like normal restaurant, and then gastronomy, right? Like the very gastronomic restaurants. I think Berlin does the gastronomic restaurants and the street food exceedingly well.
Okay.
But that middle ground, which is just normal restaurants, right? They're, in my opinion, a little too expensive. And also the culture around food is not... But that's more to do with, I think, how cosmopolitan Berlin is. And I find it less exciting. The sort of the food and wine scene is definitely there. You can find amazing things. But culturally, I think that people are a lot less excited about food. And so that's one. And the winters can be a bit...
Harsh.
A little bit, yeah.
Probably it's the length also, no? I mean, it's a part of, like, I think the last episode we talked about a little bit, like, this... Downside of, or I talk with a lot of people who lived here in Berlin or in Germany, and it's, if you have like 1 or 2 months of harsh winter, you survive. But if you have 6 months,
it
starts to become like hardcore on your mental health, especially a lot of people were saying, lack of sun. So would that be the part that you miss from France? Or if you could take something from Paris and bring it here, would it be the weather?
Not really.
Because it's not the most exciting thing in the world in Paris either.
It would certainly not be the weather. For example, this last winter was brilliant. I loved it. We had snow, which I really like. It was never too harsh. Mm-hmm. The reasons... Why for which the weather was so good, perhaps are not particularly positive, not to be celebrated. Nevertheless, the truth is it wasn't that bad. So it wasn't a problem at all. The city, you know, I mean, it's a city that's very sort of wide. It's very large, just in area. Mm. So it means that the whole city is very, it's not very dense, which means that you can, if you're already not feeling great, struggle to sort of there's a lot of gray. There's a lot of gray, and you can feel a bit overwhelmed by that. I don't think that's the biggest thing, though. The biggest thing I would bring from France to Germany to Berlin because
would be the cheese.
You can find really good French cheese as well. But cheese wouldn't be that far away. But it would be just the excitement. I would just say the excitement, not like an event, but just the general excitement of living. Like things like great conversation, the sort of a little the being
the gray mood, no? This like
impressive
thing of here, like ways of talking about things. And
It's
curious because it's a city that has thousands of activities. Like it's one of these cities that if you want to do something, there is always something to
do
in Berlin.
Yeah.
But then when you talk with people, especially people from here, from Berlin, born here and raised here, it's of course like making a majority out of nowhere, but it's not the reality for everyone. But I met a lot of people who are kind of like dark, or like not dark in the sense of being like dressing in dark, black thing.
Yeah.
But like this mood of like, I don't know. Maybe they are super happy with their life here, but they don't show it. You know?
You're right. It's a lot. I mean, it's a feature also of Berlin. I think it's something that's quite positive. Is if you're someone who doesn't like being bothered, who doesn't like sort of making a lot of conversation, if you're not very social, as you're not a very social creature, well, Berlin is very comfortable because no one generally bothers you on the streets or your interactions at the supermarket. I was going to say at the bank, but who goes to the bank these days? But don't. At, well, but
I'm Greeks a lot.
Greeks, you'd know about that. Yeah. So you can sort of have your own space, which is also, I do enjoy that a fair bit. Yeah. But I will say that there's nothing really I dislike about Berlin. I think the reason I'm considering moving back to France next year, moving back to Paris, and we'll probably get to that as well, is because I miss France for me. I miss the excitement around sort of how animated things are, how animated conversations are, and also a bit of, oh gosh, I was about to say I like some of the negativity there, but that sounds really, I don't mean that. What I mean is I like that it's a bit, there's a bit of everything. You know, it's a bit more expressive and not just necessarily people. Artistic. Yeah, the mood is more expressive and, yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean, I don't necessarily think that's better. I think it fits me better. Mm. But certainly Berlin, so in that sense, that's why I would say, it's not like my expectations were unmet. I wasn't entirely certain and I'm glad I came. And I know that when I leave, I will miss Berlin a lot, especially the cycling.
Makes sense. In that thing at the end, you're just saying that probably you're planning to go back to France and at some point. I mean,
yeah.
Do you think it's also related with the idea that you grow up there and maybe you are so used to the ways of doing of a place? The fact, like the very beginning of the episode, you were saying that you were moving here because of the fear of being in one place and then suddenly, oh fuck, I realized that I never moved or I'd always been here for the comfort, which is okay. A lot of people does that at the end. Do you think that you are actually going back due to the same fact in the sense of like, I know that and I mean, at least now you have the comparison, no?
Exactly. It had always been my goal to live in Berlin for a while. When I say always, before moving here, I spoke about it for 5 years. My friends were all sick of it. Genuinely, they were like, either just do it already or stop talking about Berlin. So in some ways, I had to do it at that point, you know, and if I didn't do it, because around the time I moved, I was very, very comfortable in Paris. And of course, our jobs, do they know that we are colleagues? We're colleagues.
If not, now they know.
Now they know. Yeah, we're colleagues. Where we work, it's a remote company. So I could have worked from Paris as well. But I decided to do it because I wanted it. And I'm glad I did. But it was never meant to be a one-time move. Sorry.
Salut.
Yeah. Allergic to Catalans.
We will reduce this. Noise waste.
You'll probably have to bring the levels down. No, sorry, yes. I was saying that, yeah, it's not necessarily a one-way move. It never is for me. Even when I go back to Paris, I might say, oh, perhaps, one of my goals is to live in Italy for about 6 months to make sure that I learn how to make pasta properly and improve my language skills. Or in Denmark, also for the language skills.
That's what I was asking. Like at the end, you're considering going back home, what you consider home at the end.
Exactly.
And it was there the idea of like maybe doing a step in between that as a more definitive move, or it's just like, okay, you want to establish Paris as a base to be there and then what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, that's exactly time, it. I don't preclude the possibility that I might live somewhere else for a bit, but I want my base to be, my home to be
So if Paris. You move to, I don't know, Denmark, Copenhagen, or like north of Italy or Italy, it would be more the idea of like going there from time to time, couple of months,
exactly.
Do something there, preserve your apartment probably in Paris, and then...
That's great, but if I can, that's brilliant what you just said, because you were like, oh, if you go to Denmark or the north of Italy or Italy, so clearly it's two different countries.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, we are also taking the look at moving to Italy. And I mean, now being in Athens, for example, like for us going to South Italy,
yeah,
the difference for being in Athens and being in Napoli, Yes, food, probably.
Yeah.
Language, of course, and different ways of being, but it's at the same distance from home. We don't win the proximity to family.
No, you
for
don't.
Example, or what we call home, no, which is at right. the end what you are trying to do, which is like establishing a place that you call fixed home and then like moving around a little bit more flexible, but having a base.
Yeah, correct. I think that would be fair.
Nice. So, 1 of 10. How much do you miss France?
Oh gosh! You see, you asked me the wrong time because I was just there yesterday. I got back yesterday. So at this particular moment, not a whole lot because there's always it's like battery, right? Like it gets like discharged, and I've got to go back and have my sort of recharge of France, and I come back here and that then allows me to enjoy Berlin even more. So at this particular moment, not a whole lot, but in general, I would put it at, I think what to be fair to Berlin, I would say on average, I miss France. When I first got here, the first year, it was probably like, after the initial honeymoon period, probably like 6 or 7 out of 10. Now I would say 4 or 5. Because I do go back every once in a while. But if I've not been there for a while, then yeah, I miss it a fair bit. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Food, restaurant, and friends. In that order. No, I'm kidding.
Friends last. What about Nepal at the end? Like as a home base?
Yes.
Like I know that your parents...
My parents are in Nepal, yeah.
Nepal, back to Nepal.
Back to Nepal from Australia. You're right,
For some time. So... That never entered the equation. It's like going back to Nepal as a time thing or as a very.
That's a great question. That's a great question that my mother will be very happy that you asked. No, you know, it's so my parents were not there either a bit earlier or when we recorded the last episode. They were with my brother in Australia. So my brother's in Australia. So now we are family in 3 continents. Which is interesting. So my relationship to Nepal is very interesting. We spoke about it in the first episode 10, I believe, of the Ausländer. And the thing is, so when my parents were not there at all, I've got family there that I miss, uncles and cousins and such, mostly cousins. I was going to say, there isn't a particular uncle I miss at all, but I think that'd be a bit rude to the many uncles who might not be listening. I'm just digging myself into a hole. I'll get out of that. So anyway, so...
Now you cannot go back to Nepal.
Now I'm banned. But now that my family is there, and I was there last year, I think it takes a while to sort of rediscover the place that you were born. And, you know, there is a lot of Nepali in me, obviously. I spent the first 18 years of my life there. And so the goal now is to try to go back at least once a year. Apart from the pandemic, we used to see each other at least once a year anyway, but that was not necessarily in Nepal. So now I want to do that. And also relevant to the second part of the podcast, I am starting to discover sort of food cultures in Nepal that I was completely unaware of because I was raised in a particular sort of part of the city, in a particular type of family. So like anywhere, you're exposed to only maybe 2% of the actual culinary spectrum that might exist in the country. And so now I'm getting interested. And the irony of the thing is I've been watching this. This is a completely free... plug for someone's YouTube. There's a guy called Tongi. He's a French guy, mm-hmm. and he speaks Nepali. Sorry, he speaks Nepali, and he goes around Nepal and tries to discover the terroir, so local food from different regions. And I'm watching these videos. And I'm thinking, gosh, I've not tried most of these things, so I want to do that. So it's a French guy who's introducing me to Nepalese cuisine through YouTube. And my brother is I think a little more connected to that these days. So through him and through channels like that, I want to sort of rediscover and perhaps rebuild that bridge to Nepal. Yeah, that's definitely something I want to do soon. But yes. As you know, I'm someone who really is focused on things that are around me physically. I have trouble thinking of things that are physically far away. And that's also one of the reasons I want to go back physically every year. And that'll allow me to sort of be there, both physically and mentally.
Nice.
Yeah.
So maybe before just jumping to the second part, I want just to propose a little this or that, let's say like
Oh,
this.
Hello.
If you need to choose, like there is no option, you need to choose one option or the other.
Right.
Like, it's someone it's pointing you.
Yeah.
So you with a gun and like
A or B or exactly. Else I have to live in Germany forever. Right. So
exactly.
Like okay.
Full hipster Berlin.
Oh gosh.
Full techno Berlin.
Oh, that's the question. Full hipster Berlin or full techno Berlin? I thought these questions were gonna be easy. I'll go for full you know what? Techno Berlin.
Hmm?
Yeah, techno.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a funny one, okay. Parks inside of the city or leaving the city?
Oh, leaving the city.
Exiting, like...
Yeah, like I want to be able to go out and that's what I like doing. Yeah.
Okay.
Nice. I mean, I still want parks in the city, but yeah.
It's an interesting thing because at the end, like a lot of like people who lived in Berlin says this kind of dichotomy of this city. You know, it's a great city. Architecturally wise, especially.
Yeah.
But then suddenly, if they compare it to other big cities of Europe, it has a lot of parks.
Oh, you know, in defense of Berlin, which is still a city I love, it's extremely green. And the number of lakes you have around
but
the city.
You just hear this sentence like, it's extremely green next to extremely gray.
You're right,
which is really funny because it's like you're putting right. The two opposites. Like, I understand
what
it means.
In the winter, it's not green. Yeah.
No, and when you come here, even if you come in winter at the end, like the parks are still absolutely
right.
Green if it's not snown. But
yeah. Oh, you're right. That's an interesting. Yeah, that's a very good point.
I understand. You need to be here to understand that the architecture it's brutal.
Yeah.
Certain parts of the city it's even more brutal.
Yeah.
It can get very dirty very quick. This city, let's say like this also.
Yeah.
But then suddenly you go to I don't know Treptow Park and you have. Kilometers of park to walk without any problem.
This is amazing. And also, again, in defense of Berlin, the historical sort of significance of the city, I mean, I'm very interested in espionage. Well, that's an odd thing to say. I'm interested in the history of espionage. This is still a very... Berlin was at the crossroads of so many cultures and so many sort of significant events in world history, European history, but also the world history. So the remnants of that are still present. And for example, you can still see a very strong divisions between the East and the West. Yeah. And I find that fascinating. But beyond that, like I said earlier, you can ride, you can wake up in the morning, take your bicycle, ride, have lunch in Poland and come back to Berlin and have dinner in Berlin. This is possible even today, right? Like you can do it quite easily. So we're very much in central... I would argue that Berlin is a central European city, not a Western European city. Because, you know, we're not... In terms of the latitude, we're not that far from longitude, sorry, not latitude, from Austria. In Vienna, sorry. And Prague. I don't take my word on that. Do check a map because I am not very strong in geography. When someone looks at a map, and what on earth is he talking about? But you get what I'm trying to say.
I don't know if there is a lot of people in geography listening to my podcast. But
all right.
If they are, no problem. They will comment.
Will
no problem.
Yes.
Okay. Next question. And I have two more.
Go on then.
One. Might be putting you in conflict with the German people, whatever you respond.
That's fine.
And the second one probably will put you either with the German or the French. So the first one, it's Berlin beer or beer from anywhere outside of Berlin.
Oh, anywhere outside of Berlin. It's obvious.
No, there is people who are very strong opinions
about Berlin
beer.
No, I mean, south of Germany, Belgium, I also like the beer scene in Denmark. Mm. But certainly not Berlin beer, no. Not
too watery?
Easy. No, just not very interesting. I mean, Germany is brilliant for beer, but it's mostly all from the south. So yeah.
Right. Okay, the last question this section. German bread or French bread?
Ah, French bread.
Yes?
No, not even a competition, mate.
Yeah.
Nah, very easy. I mean, I know it's supposed to be better. No, okay, to be fair to Germany, the variety is brilliant, and there's a lot of like interesting grains. I'm a creature of habits. I like, you know, when I go to the boulangerie, and we're not going to talk about sort of all the croissant and the pain au chocolat, all that. That's different.
No, I'm talking about bread. Pure bread, yeah. Like. But I'm not very, pastries.
Exactly, not of that, yeah. In that case, I want, all I need, right, me personally, is une baguette traditionnelle, mm-hmm. enfin, une tradition, or une baguette classique, you know, just like a...
Classical baguette.
Yeah, or the tradition. Beyond that, there are also interesting things in France, but I very rarely get anything else. So, a lack of imagination, perhaps, but I'm very, very simple, and I like white bread.
No, it's all right. I mean, here in Germany, they are very famous to doing other kinds of bread.
Other kinds
black
of bread.
Breads, grains with varieties, a little bit more like toasted stuff and a little bit more different. If you're a classic person who you want like baguette in a classic white bread, let's say like this,
certainly,
of course
yeah.
you will go for the French one.
Yeah, and also, you know, it might be healthier, right? But I would also put it to you that drinking water is healthier than drinking wine. And here we are. There's a reason we drink the wine.
Yes, that's also true. But yeah, now that we are talking about food, maybe we can directly jump to the to the second part.
Yeah,
if
yeah,
you
yeah.
Like.
Well, let's do it. Let's do it.
Sure.
Perhaps a cheers.
Sure.
There we go.
Let's go.
The expert building a cuisine repertoire.
Let's start with the second part. Everyone who follows Parimal in social media knows that his stories are literally a 90% cooking, 10% cats. And by cats, I mean Carl. Only this, normally. So I proposed which topic we wanted to discuss. And of course, like, I led that to the guests, and at the end, you are cooking a lot. Like
yeah.
You cook a lot at home, but you also like, as we could see in the first part of the episode, one of the main reasons for you like to like one place or the other, it's the quality of the restaurant, it's the quality of the I don't know, the wine bars, the
yeah.
places where you can go out and have a good meal. Where does the cooking part comes from? Like, when did you start cooking?
Well, I don't remember a start because I think it's a family thing. For many people, it is that. And I've got a family who loves being in the kitchen. So in my family, we've got like two different cultures. So my mum's side of the family they're very specific about how they cook food. It's a very traditional approach, but not traditional sort of traditional Nepalese. It's traditional to her family.
Mm-hmm.
So that was there from I was very young. My dad is, he likes improvising. He likes experimenting. But we always sort of have loved food. We've always cooked a lot as a family. And often when we have like a dinner, I wouldn't say we argue to decide who cooks, but it's sort of almost like you want to be the one making food. So I think from a very young age, I think it came from my parents. And then when, you know, as you move to different areas of the world, as you grow up, you start developing sort of a taste for the food cultures, not only because of the flavors, but for what food represents socially and the importance that food has for people and people's sense of culture, people's sense of identity. Mm. So I'm very drawn to that. And so whilst I don't know when it started, I do know why it's there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it comes from family, but at the end, you cook a lot of French recipes generically, no? Because at least what I've seen is that you have a very established like recipe book or whatever in your mind, French-wise. Do you still cook any Nepalese food?
Yeah, no.
I mean, you said that you are starting to discover like some YouTubers and whatever now. So are you also like trying to get to cook that?
Yeah, okay. Good question. So right now, I love, you know, so pianists, people who play the piano, use the word repertoire in English. And the repertoire is are the pieces that they play, that they're comfortable playing. So you can say, all right, Grieg's concerto in A minor is in my repertoire or not. And I am building my repertoire as, chef is a big word, but someone who likes to, a hobbyist chef. Mm. And the dishes that I'm working on right now are Italian and French. I love traditional French cuisine, and when you asked me how much you miss France on a scale of 1 to 10, my mind was immediately going to how much French food, yeah. and French brasserie and all that. So, in terms of cooking, I am mostly working on that because that's my culture. That's the culture that I didn't get from my family. I got the love of cooking from my family and the love of eating together with from my family. My love for French cuisine or Italian cuisine is my own thing. I don't know if we've talked about it in the last episode in which I was a guest, but I became French in 2019. So I became a French national. Yeah, I think I mentioned that. And that also somehow, some people say, oh, it's only a technical thing. No, not for me. It was a very important part of my life. And I sort of had this intense desire to really be more in touch with this country that is now my home and is my only country. I'm only a citizen of France. And so I went found this rabbit hole, this wonderful rabbit hole. You know, often when you say that, you know, you're trying to dig yourself out. No, I'm quite the opposite. I'm a rabbit who, that's a weird sentence. I'm a rabbit who's trying to dig deeper holes.
And cooking the rabbit at the same
time. Yeah, I'm cooking the rabbit at the same time. Oh, delicious with the oven, with a bit of Herbe de Provence and a bit of olive oil and nothing else. Brilliant.
Now half of the listeners of the podcast who are not Mediterranean are leaving the podcast because who the fuck cooks rabbits?
Oh, I didn't realize that was a trap. I genuinely
now let's talk about snails. Yeah, sure.
Snails are not that common. They're from Burgundy, the classic ones, but are delicious.
We do them. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, but to answer the second part of your question, which was about Nepalese food. Now, this is... I am cooking more Nepalese food, but my goal is very particular right now, which is that there's food from Nepal that I know. Mm. Three categories, right? Food from Nepal that I know. There's food from Nepal that I don't know that I'm willing, I'm curious about trying. And then there's food that I grew up with. And for some reason, the food that I grew up with, I can't find anywhere else in Nepal apart from... when my mom cooks it, when my aunt cooks it, so my mom's sister, or when my grand aunt cooks it. Because it was a very familial thing. And
coming from the part of this family that you said that is more like traditional cooking in that sense, like that they follow more like the rules.
Yeah, yeah. It's not even the rules. What happens is, and this, I have to be very careful when I explain this part because my knowledge of this area is very limited. So a lot of the influences on that side, there's Nepalese, there's a bit of Indian, and there's quite a fair bit of Persian.
Okay.
Because they are the Shahi family, and they, I don't know how much I can talk about this, not because for legal reasons, just because my knowledge is limited.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, it's because that they were related to the royal family back in the day. They were not the royal family, but they were close around it. And so in that world, there was a lot of very strong Persian influence, and there are some techniques in cooking that are not, you can't find them.
So it's arriving to a point that it's more like family recipes than traditional Nepalese food at the end.
It's not, yeah, exactly.
At the same time, I'm asking because it's which part of the family it is, because it tends to happen like this, like the part of the families or the families that are following the recipe book in a very strict way.
Yeah.
Tend to have a recipe book.
You're right.
The part who is, or the cooks or the chefs who are very creative, they tend to improvise things, and they tend to like, oh, I open the fridge and then I see
That's my father, yeah.
I'm going more into that direction, although I would really, really love to have something from my grandma, for example.
Yeah.
Unluckily, I never met, but or my grandpa who died like some years ago, and he was cooking fish into another level, like,
yeah.
And these recipes, I know that my mom know how to do them, and I learned some of them from both my mom and my grandpa, but there is some of that I would have loved that was written down somewhere.
Exactly.
You know, like, and that's something that I miss absolutely.
But that's exactly it. So when part of my repertoire is, right now, sort of the things I'm working on, the pieces I'm working on, if I were learning to play the piano, which I also am, that's another topic.
Of course, as a man of Renaissance.
I'm not very good at it yet. So French food, but traditional. Because traditional French food is about techniques. Mm. So escoffier, les sauces, you know, the basics.
Yeah.
And then, but also regional food. I love that. Because food tells a story. And in some ways, I think I'm not actually interested necessarily in the food. I'm interested in the stories that these recipes tell. The second bit is then Italian, but I'm really focusing on pasta. And the third bit is going to be then the familial recipes from my mom's side. Mm. Because I think if there is no documentation of it properly, and if there is a risk of these recipes just not
being lost.
And I'm fascinated by people who are librarians or are interested in archiving, sort of.
So are you even considering like keeping them, like doing some kind of blog out of it, or some kind of like?
Absolutely.
You have in a small web, not because it's small, the web itself, it's because it's designed in a small web approach for everyone who doesn't know what a small web is like. The antithesis of like making webs complicated.
Yeah, and the antithesis of the corporate web where there's a financial incentive. Exactly. But you're absolutely right. My goal is to try to document these recipes, mm-hmm. put it on the web, and essentially open source all of these recipes. I have no interest, obviously, in keeping it. It's food. Yeah. The food is. I've been criticized, and you know, rightly, for being a bit too conservative sometimes with food, right? But it's, and you know, the anti-fusion guy. That's not entirely true. What I don't like is when there's things that are mixed together without an understanding of the why. If the why is there, then I'm fine. So
the Japanese-Peruvian approach for
the Japanese. Yeah,
I went to a restaurant the other, like some months ago. Like they were doing Japanese-Peruvian cuisine, and of course from the various extract part, you seem like, what the fuck, what are they doing
that?
You
know, like, why, yeah.
It just ended that they are two guys who are married, and one is Peruvian and the other is Japanese. Okay, whatever, I understand the story behind it, and that's all right. Yeah. But it's difficult to mix.
If you are working with the techniques, you are working with an understanding of the ingredients, right? And an understanding of the interplay of these things, then something beautiful can come out of it.
Sure.
And one of my, oh gosh, this is going to sound so pretentious, but as a French person, I do have the right. we already have that.
Oh, gosh.
Already have that reputation. So
building stereotypes of French.
Some of them are not bad. So one of my favorite recipes to work on, and I'm also giving this away, because it's not mine to begin with, is, so there's a dish called Puli Basquez. Mm-hmm. You know, it's from the Southwest, classic with peppers, tomato, and it's with chicken, also usually from the South. And it's a lovely sort of dish that's slightly soupy, Pimo Desplet. And there's a dish, there's a version of that dish that I create, which is the risotto version of it. Mm-hmm. So, so using the liquids from the soup, rather, the sauce, use that as the bouillon, the broth.
Broth. Yeah.
Thank you. For the risotto. And that allows you to make a poulet, risotto basquez. Mm-hmm. So it's a poulet basquez in risotto form. And then you serve the chicken on the sides, on a, when you do the dressage mm-hmm. next to it. So this is sort of, it's, and the pretentious part is for me to call it my signature dish, but it is one of my signature dishes. That's fusion, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I don't know if you share this, but at the end, like, I'm a person who likes to try at restaurants and go and have, not all the time, of course, I'm not as rich to do that, but I like to go to this kind of like gastro that you were saying, like not the middle class restaurants, but from time to time going to something that has a Michelin star, for example,
right, yeah,
or
yeah.
two Michelin. It doesn't matter, like something that it's there or that I can try because the curiosity. What it has been happening to me for quite some time, it's that there was a set way of doing Michelin right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that there was a lot of restaurants that were really repetitive in what they were doing in that sense. And trying, and some of them trying techniques that were not for what you are doing. So losing the tradition of where you are, and, yeah. And I'm going to say that from perspective, I don't know, I remember a Michelin star in London, Indian one. Incredible.
Okay.
Like I mean, you know the Indian from Indian food, either because you've been in India or because you taste here the, from Indian restaurants,
right.
which normally they need to reduce the spices, they need to bring it a little bit down because right. of like, if not, people don't buy from them. No, which is sad. Of course, it's sad, but it's what it is. They it need is to. They at the end they adapt to the thing, or they don't have the ingredients for doing what they would do at home.
Yeah, yeah.
Being a Michelin star in a place like London, that there is a lot of Indian community.
Yeah.
It was an incredible experience, but because it was still traditional in the sense of like they were. Reinventing Indian cuisine, but they were doing Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
They were not lost in something that it's not from anywhere.
That's a big risk, I think, in cuisine in general. You do want to add your touch. You do want to be innovative. Because there's something you want to surprise your guests. Yeah. What if you want to surprise you want to give them an experience. But it's the same in music as well. You can get lost in trying to be innovative. And I've also found myself sometimes in that, you know, music, trying to do all these things. Then you realize like a four chord song sometimes can elicit pleasure and excitement and joy without needing the complexity. So then you have to go back and ask yourselves, what is that complexity for, right? And if you can answer that question, and the answer can be as simple as, oh, it's fun. That's enough. But you do need to know the why.
I understand, but at the end it's different that you explore and you play around when you are cooking at home and then you're trying things, and most of the things that they do in this kind of restaurants you cannot do it at home.
No, you can't.
But even if you explore mixing things at home, it's you doing your thing and that's all. You are not charging anyone 200 euros or 150 euros, you know,
you should be able to do anything at home, you know, and
exactly, but that's your playground.
That's your playground.
To do whatever you want and then come with the recipe refined or not refined. Or like it was one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, because at the end you were talking about, like, for example, having as a reference of your recipes the French part and then having the Italian ones, which are the two types of cuisines that are antagonic in some kind of ways. The French processes are long, are depurated, are perfected, are whatever, while the Italian, it's the base of Italian cuisine at the end. It's like, not for having more ingredients, it means that it tastes better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The processes needs to be simple.
You're absolutely right.
And need to be traditional.
Yeah.
And how does it fit in your mentality, these two, like?
I love this question. I love this question because I like talking about it and nobody ever asks. So I am being asked for once, so I'll answer. So let's start with an example, all right? It's a cliche, what I'm going to mention, but we're going to talk about carbonara. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, carbonara is traditional in a way that the pad thai is traditional, in which it's not very old, the recipe. Some people even dated as early as the Second World War, right? But it is traditional, at least in the space that it occupies in people's minds. Now, the carbonara is a Roman pasta that's very basic in the ingredients, right? You have spaghetti, bucatini, whatever pasta you're using. You have eggs, you have guanciale, and you have pepper. You don't need anything else. That's carbonara.
That's the magic of most of Italian recipes.
The magic. But there is some, and I get frustrated because it's very creamy pasta, right? And so often in France, for example,
with the creams.
And to me, this is a typical example, you know, of, and people say, well, if I like it with cream, why can't I have it? Of course you can have it. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, just call it pasta with cream.
Pasta with cream. I think, and this is me, so that's my perspective, not necessarily saying it's the correct one, although it is. So the way to get that creaminess in the Italian approach, right, is that there's a process of emulsification that happens between the pecorino completely, but the pecorino, the cheese, and the pasta water emulsifies. And the best way to do it is this: there's a process called mantecare, right? So at the end, when you are mixing everything, well, you don't need to do this with. I'm using the wrong pasta as an example. I should have used amatriciana. But anyway, the point is there's a gesture that which is sort of, you know,
buttering things.
Yeah, exactly. So mantecare, you can call it a number of others. There are other words that you can use also for that. But the point is to mix it enough that this emulsification happens and this creamy texture is there. And that texture is very much part of what makes it enjoyable. And so I guess they are diametrically opposed because the French approach is reduction, sources, more complex preparations. There are exceptions, of course. And the Italian approach is 5 ingredients, sometimes 3. But the technique is really, really important.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, when you go to Bologna and you need to know tortelloni, for example, and they do tortellini a brodo, which is with a broth, and it's as simple as it is, like a tortellini pasta, like, of course, but the pasta needs to be done in one way, the tortellini, depending on what filling it has, it needs to be turned in one way or the other to mark that it's different from the other. Bringing it into a broth of chicken or vegetables, it's special because it makes the filling soft. These kind of things, I meant it from a very, like, ingredient perspective.
At the end,
Italian cuisine is like, let's try to, like, reiterate on this same recipe with very, very few ingredients that we have at hand until we perfect it to a craziness. I know that France does that also in that sense, but does it from very different perspective.
Absolutely.
Like from long boiling times, from long cooking times. While the Italian, it's more like I prepare something and then I cook it 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's Gino da Campo said, minimum, I'm going to do the accent, minimum effort, maximum results. And that's often I find the credo of, let me ask you, right? Because your listeners and your viewers know you fairly well now, but would you agree that
I don't know if they know me, like, actually I interview people all the time and I'm they know a lot of my guests. But
maybe they don't know you very well, so this has been an occasion. So you've got a background that is obviously Catalan. There's a bit of Italian in you, obviously. A good part of you is Italian. Mm. You've lived in a number of different regions, including Germany.
Yes.
So would you agree, disagree, or have a third opinion that a lot of great food comes from poverty?
Of course. I mean, people need to eat. And the recipes that are the most crazy comes from times of need. And that's how it is, no? And a lot of the things that we eat right now are rich and they are addictive. That's different. It doesn't mean that they are good. Like, There is really good chips and potato chips in the market, but you eat them because they're addictive, not because they are extremely good.
Yeah.
My grandma or my grandpa used to fry the bone of the fish, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it gives a tasty salt that the chips will never have it, and you eat it as an aperitif thing, you eat together with a vermouth, and yeah, like in certain parts of Spain they call it raspa, and that's incredible, and that's literally out of meat, like you need to use the fish until the point of like using the bones of
right,
the
animal. Yeah.
But that's exactly the same as cooking bone marrow. That's out of the need that you start eating the inside of a bone.
Yeah.
Bone marrow, it's incredible.
It's taste wise. And you can now go to a Michelin star restaurant and order.
And they will put your bone marrow as the most sophisticated thing in the world. But that's because most of these things were discovered by someone who was hungry.
Yeah. And so, and I really think, and this is why I think, you know, there's a place for all of this. I do enjoy gastronomy. I do enjoy it for also the visual and the sensual aspect to it. It's a weird way to say it, but I often liken it to an artist working on his or her craft. But it's a very different art craft than when you're in Nepal. This is the bit of the police food I'm really interested in. When you go to a certain part, I discover this. Gosh, this is very embarrassing because I don't know what this dish is called. It uses the intestines, and it's covered with, but what's in it is bone marrow, I believe. So not noble parts of of an animal. And I don't even know what animal is used. I think it's a lamb. I don't know. This is why you can see I'm getting interested, but I don't have the knowledge, right? So this is an exciting place to be. And I tried it, and my first reaction was, this is very interesting. Second reaction was, why do people eat this? Because the initial, it's strong. And then as you have it with some beer and you have that, you know, amongst friends, then I started loving it also for, because there's a certain part of, and I can't even tell you which subculture in Nepal this comes from. And I wish I'd researched this, but I'm just speaking from memory. It allows you to sort of connect to food that people are eating and they're so proud to show you that this is their food. Yeah. And it's a way to connect it to people. And so this is the bit that I'm really, so I told you there's a familial side, that's different, but I'm also interested in sort of figuring out discovering street food in Nepal for that exact same reason.
Yeah, makes sense. Talking about street food actually also, like, we talk about it like before here, Berlin, there is like street food from absolutely everywhere in the world, but not too much of traditional German food at the end.
Nope.
Is it a reflection of the situation of the city in the sense of like expats don't want to eat German food, or it's due to the fact that German food doesn't have quality I'm not saying that there is not good German food. I'm questioning if the fact that there is three Vietnamese in one single street in the non-touristic area of Berlin, it's just a reflection that even the Germans prefer to grab a quick Viet Pho than trying to go for sauerkraut.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, I think. So Berlin's never really been too good about German food. And a lot of German food tends to be, in my opinion, very hearty, sort of more...
filling. And
yeah, more filling. And I love German food traditions. And you've spent some time in Hessen, so you know about Handkäse mit Musik and all that.
Grüne Soße, Schnitzels, of course.
And so there is sort of a lot of regionality in that. I think I enjoy that greatly. But certainly, apart from the Currywurst, which is a Berlin sort of dish, they aren't...
Using Indian spices?
Yeah, using Indian spices. And also a very simplified version, of Indian spices. But I think Berlin, the strength of Berlin is you can find food from anywhere in the world, any niche that you can imagine. Like, for example, if you want Nepalese Momo, this is brilliant. If you want Nepalese Momo, there's a Momo stall. Because Momo traditionally is sold from little sort of stalls on the street. And they're made in mass quantities. It's not very expensive. It's anyone can afford it. And it's in Kathmandu, you'll find one in every 50 meters. I'm exaggerating, but only slightly. So in Warschauer Straße, not very far from here, there's a little stall and you can find Momo that is 80% authentic to what you would find in Kathmandu for similar prices, if I'm completely honest. And it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, this is just almost street food level, Kathmandu street food level food you're getting in the middle of Berlin. That's the crazy thing about Berlin. It's just insane. Like, why? But
do you think there was a kitchen, like cuisine? And now I'm just trying to do it a little bit like with the comparison that I know. No, for example, like Barcelona, we are arriving to a point where tourism, it's taking the city 100% in that sense. It's difficult. Like, there is, of course, places that they are doing Catalan dishes.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of places that are not doing Catalan cuisine. And because we are losing, I mean, Italian restaurants have always been there. That's not a big deal. But every time we are having more, like, I don't know, fast food also. Right. You'll find empanadas from Argentina, piadinas entering from there, dessert, whatever. And the Catalan cuisine, which is rich enough to have their culture in there, it's reduced to very top-notch restaurants, which do interpretations of this cuisine. They don't even do like real, like traditional. I right now, like, I don't really know where to have an escudella in Barcelona, for example.
What is that?
It's a broth made with vegetables and part of bone of the chicken and whatever. Like, it's a very traditional. It was assumed to the it's called the Christmas of Barcelona, and we do it with this big pasta in Christmas. But
I gotta try this.
Now there is a person doing street food of escudella. I don't know where he is based, but as if it was like the Catalan version of ramen. And I find it incredible. I find it really nice, the idea, if the prices would reflect what an escudella cost.
I see.
If it wouldn't be a thematic approach to sell Catalan tradition to tourists, and only to tourists.
If you would
be doing Catalan dishes for the people who are still living in Barcelona, which is not a lot of people.
Yeah.
But I think this is happening also here in Berlin. There is very few Berliners living in Berlin. Like, at least in the center areas of Berlin, everyone lives in the outside. And I don't really know, and I am always been curious about it. Like, there is a traditional Berliner kitchen around, or not, or it's reduced to the currywurst that we were saying.
But currywurst is very much, I would, it's not something that people eat very often. It's a snack, isn't it?
Exactly. Like, it's like an eat to go day that you have three meetings in between and then you squeeze 20 minutes
or often, you went out drinking and you have it, like, just like kebab. There are sort of DDR restaurants. German Democratic Republic, East Germany, had its own traditional culinary traditions that were based on a bit of like Soviet influence, Polish influence, and there are restaurants that do that and are very affordable still, and it's always an experience. I wouldn't say the food is not elegant food, but there is history in there, and I always enjoy going to that sort of restaurants. Or you can also go to very near from here in Bezarinplatz, there's sort of Küchen für Jedermann, or Küche für Jedermann. So it's for canteen, traditionally for workers, I imagine, but anyone can go and the prices are very, very reasonable.
Okay.
And you get traditional German food. Shockingly, I've not been there yet, almost because I'm intimidated to go. But I do intend on going there. And those sort of places still exist. And the beauty is it's open to everybody.
In Barcelona and in Catalonia and Spain in general, still exists the menu of the midday, like the three dishes thingy for 10 euros. But it's not 8 to 10 euros anymore. Now it's 15, 16,
It's 18, a bit prohibitive,
you know, like, it's just like, it's really overpriced for the salaries that they are paying people in Spain like right now. It's crazy. It's I don't know. This is still the tradition of cooking of whatever, but that's guerrilla cooking that we say a little bit, not in the sense of like you fry a chicken quick and it's what you need. It's needed to be like this because these people need to eat fast because they have 30 minutes break in between.
That's nice,
they fitting a 3-courses menu into a 30 minutes break. You cannot be cooking a reduction of risotto or whatever, you know, like it's what it is.
You're not doing fancy sauces.
But yeah, I think it's getting lost in that sense.
So, and you lament that loss?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, not only the fact of losing like the Catalan traditional or Catalan or everything. I'm pretty sure that there is like places in Madrid that are suffering the same thing or in Bilbao or whatever it is that we have a bigger problem. Like I think Barcelona and Madrid. Madrid is still a bigger city than Barcelona, and it sends Barcelona. It's becoming impossible to live. Salary prices, restaurants, etc. At the same point that it's like when you have 3 times the tourism every day than people living in there, you are having a model of city that it's only for tourists. So you are losing this kind of traditional thing. So
I will say that one of the cool things about Berlin is. Sure, inflation has caused prices to rise. Nevertheless, it remains still, to this day, quite an affordable city. Getting an apartment is insane. Don't even try. But if you are able to find your space in Berlin, you can still live comfortably without paying a whole lot of money. And it's still more expensive than before, but compared to any other European capital, to the west and to the south. To the south depends. I think we eat lovely, amazing things in Genova for very, very little money. But in a city like Berlin,
It's not a European capital.
It's not a European capital.
Try to find a flat in Rome.
Try to find a flat in Rome. Yeah, no, I see. Yeah. But one of my biggest disappointments, and this is, I don't know why this affected me so much. This was a period when I was missing France so much. And I was watching, there's a show called 10%. It's called Call My Agent, I think, in Netflix. Mm-hmm. I was watching that and it really made me miss France. That was my sort of way to try to think about when you're missing things, you try to consume things that are from your home. So I was consuming a lot of French things. And my flatmate, in a lovely gesture said, let's go to a French restaurant. And we were three people. We went to the restaurant, a restaurant quite close to where we are right now. And I saw on the menu coucou vin. Yeah, classic coucou vin is chicken that is slow cooked, so braised with red wine traditionally, with lots of onions and small vegetables. And it's delicious. So I ordered it, and I noticed before I ordered it that it was with white wine. There is a white wine variation that you can do. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. It's a slightly sort of a chef's interpretation. And it was not cheap. It was more than what I would ever pay for coucou vin in France. Because French food tends to be, for some reason, very expensive. But I thought, I'm missing it a lot. And it's a sort of a special restaurant and ordered it. And what came was, I've never been as disappointed, I think, in what I've ordered. It was white wine sauce. That was sort of was a reduction. It was a braised sauce, but the chicken was just simply sort of roasted chicken, very dry on top of it. It's not braised at all. And to me, charging that much for a coucou vin that is not even does not respect not the first two rules, too. Of coucou vin. I was so disappointed. Mm-hmm. And the amount of money we paid for that. I'm sure they have other dishes and I won't mention the name of the restaurant, which is called Chez Maurice, but it was quite a shame. Everything else was very good though, but the coucou vin was a disappointment.
It happens. Well, arriving to this point, cooking for yourself.
Yeah.
Cooking for others.
Yeah.
Or getting cooked like, I let anyone else cooking for me.
I think I appreciate all of those things, but my favorite thing to do is to cook for other people. That's that. I love that. But to do that, I have to try multiple times. So if I have a recipe in mind, I'll try two or three times on myself.
Always?
I don't
think I'm a risky chef, like in that sense, like I throw recipes that I've never done.
I don't think I've ever given something to a guest that I'm not. Maybe
and now nobody will want to come to my place, but yeah, sure.
Well, first of all, make sure that he invites you first, and then for the record, he's not invited me yet. But in his defense, he is an
actor. You haven't been to where I live ever. Like, what the fuck?
That's also a fair point. So yes, I think for cooking for other people, that's that. I love that.
Mm.
Yeah, always.
In that cooking part, and it's something that I missed to ask before. Cooking what you cook, which is not from the region that you are, might be difficult for certain ingredients, for certain kind of things. One of the things that was difficult for me, for example, here was fish in Germany. I was in Frankfurt. I don't know if they offer here, but where do you buy here in Berlin?
So for fish, particularly in Berlin, since there's a lot of lakes in the area, if you're going for sort of river fish, this is very easy. It's quite
it's
good.
My problem.
That's you want the sea sort of okay, saltwater fish. That's harder in but to be fair, some of the best fish is frozen. And last time I said this, people were like, I'm gonna get a scratch, because if good frozen fish, that's tiefgefroren, right? Like so deep frozen. If it's directly after it's been caught, that's the best way to transport fish, unless you're right next to the source.
Unless your family comes from fishermen.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, for you, your level, your standards are quite
standard.
Yeah,
of course, that's the problem. That it's just like, it's difficult.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
Mm. So for my Italian needs, there's Centro Italia. If I'm cooking a proper, like a very sort of slightly complicated meal, I go to Fisher Paradis, but it's too expensive.
Vegetables?
Oh, In Paris.
And I'm not blaming the Germans into this.
No.
Like everything that arrives here, it's from the south of Spain. So
it's the weather. It's the weather. It's also the climate,
that's what it is. But actually right now, like, it's ridiculous. That, I mean, of course, like, if you go to Basque Country or to Madrid in winter, the weather is what it is. Like, the tomatoes that you will have in there are literally from Huerta down. Or if you have your fruit shop and vegetable shop of confidence, they will have better quality. But if you go to the supermarket and grab the first tomato that you find there, it will be exactly the same tomato that you will find
absolutely
here in any supermarket.
Yeah, so the tomatoes here come from Spain and Morocco, and from Belgium for some reason. One of the things I miss about France and Paris is also that like there are streets on there where you have the primeur, the vegetable sellers, the fishmongers, the cheese store, these are separate. The caviste, and all of these things where you can go and buy certain things. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't really always go to the primeur for the vegetables. I more often than not go to the supermarket anyway. And
it's a difficult concept. I mean, I'm extremely in favor of small shops instead of like big brands, and especially like supermarkets who are providing from that. But
yeah.
Willingly or not, you are passing through the supermarket for certain products, because even if you are in the most decentralized country, Greece is a big example of that, like all the small shops are still surviving. Like, I don't know when it's the last time that you saw a shop of small buttons of handle doors. In Greece, there is thousands of them because they survive because their clientele is still loyal to them 100%. And that's beautiful, but at the same time, you don't have a provider of cleaning products.
Yeah, you can't just...
No? Like, at the end, you need to pass to the supermarket for other kind of products. You buy other things in the supermarket that are not there. But quality of it.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, and also, we are living in inflationary times, and I also take certain pleasure in going to the supermarket. Like, I go to my local Etika, and I really enjoy.
Etika has good quality.
Oh, Etika has some, we even have a fresh.
Etika is not paying for this promotion.
Etika is not paying. They really should be. I love Etika. And no, but to go back to the, the image of going to is like a small vegetable store. There's a good chance that the products that come there, in Paris at least, most of the fresh produce goes through Rungis. And there's a good chance you're getting pretty much the same. It comes from Rungis. But the selection is often different because in Rungis you can go from, you know, sort of zero to 100. I mean, I'm exaggerating again. But yeah, so I do, but I miss, like I said, if I'm doing apéro with my friends, I like to go to, there's a, one of my friends lives in the Marais and there's a street called Rue Bretagne. And there's a particular shop I go for cheese. There's an Italian trattoria who ripped me off recently because I ended up getting two cheeses when I was, I try to speak in Italian and sometimes I get overexcited and I don't listen to what I'm saying and I end up ordering more than I actually need. And then I don't correct myself because I'm...
Because why not? 2 kilos of cheese, why not?
Two cheeses is not bad. And anyway, so there's all these lovely stores. If we're doing an apéro at my friend's place, we go to all these lovely little places and I like that. And it's not necessarily the products are also very important, but the ritual, which of course has no inherent value, but has a sort of experiential or aspirational value.
And a community value.
Yeah. Community value, yeah. And that means something to me, yeah.
Yeah, I hope at some point this will go back and it's something that I will miss from Greece, 100%. Like the
when you move to Italy.
Yeah, but Italy also, like, Greece, it's still in this time, like in the sense of like, you still have every day a market in every different neighbor with the vegetables, with the farmers coming directly to there, and you're shopping from the farmers directly. Very small shops, and this in certain parts of Italy might be like that, and you will need to know who is the producer and everything. But it's remarkable from the Greeks still to maintain this kind of like.
Oh, I need to visit.
I'm not saying that the Greek cuisine is the most creative in the world, because it's not. It's rather like the Italian, they go basic and they go simple and whatever. They toast and roast and burn the meat a little bit too much for my taste. But besides that, I mean, you eat really good prices. And it happens a phenomenon that tavernas or restaurants are cheaper than supermarkets. And that's why there is still a lot of culture of like going every single meal to go out, whatever. Because if you try to reproduce what you order in the tavern, it will cost you so much.
Speaking of food, see, for him, I suppose I am becoming the food. Because look at that. You're not meant to eat me. Look at that. Well, I suppose we all appreciate a bit of
love.
Well, this is very tough love as far as love goes. Okay, Bob.
Well, I think the last question, just to close, we are finishing our wines and closing the episode with a wine question.
Oh, lovely.
Red or wines?
Oh, I mean, yeah, oh gosh.
Or when, what?
Yes, okay, I think that's a, yeah. So generally I prefer drinking red, but it depends a lot on the weather, the environment, even the lighting. Right. If it's a sort of low-key lighting, you want red, obviously. So for me, if it's white, I prefer things that are very mineral, very dry. So typically with, say, oysters, I prefer like Muscadet. It's very classic. I'm not inventing anything here. Or a very, very dry, like a Chablis. Yeah, I do enjoy those. Or Chardonnay is a classic, yeah, from Bourgogne and Burgundy. If it's a red, my natural tendencies go towards... deeper, sort of full-bodied wines, like with Syrah, Beauvais, so from the south of France, could also be from Italy. So that are more spicy, more sort of peppery, or I'm translating from French. Boisé, charpenté, woods-like. Yeah. But then there's also, sometimes I enjoy vin de macération, so orange wine, right? So a white wine that has been treated like a red wine, so there's some skin contact. That sounds weird in English, but I do enjoy that, but more for apéro, before the dinner. And in terms, as far as bubbles go, I'm a big fan of Crémant. So from the Loire, there's lovely minerality from the Loire region, or obviously from Alsace. And I promise you, I did not pre-prepare that sentence. I genuinely, these are the wines I like the most. What about you?
Oof. It's difficult. I mean, I was raised in a world of reds, let's say like this, and moved to world of whites completely. Oh. Because at the end, here in Germany, especially when you move to the Rhine and Mosel area and everything, the predominance it's the white wines. If I need to choose from here, I'm also going more to the dry sense of it, or sometimes sweet white wines are okay.
Yeah. But
for me, it's more like an association of white wines during the day, or like the
with the sun.
It's like a little bit more summerish vibe into it, let's say like this. And I really like a variety which is called Gewürztraminer.
Gewürztraminer. Also in Alsace, we have that. Yeah.
I mean, I enjoy a good red, but
lately
also in Greece, the white wine quality, it's better than the red wine generically.
Okay. So,
but if you're going to try any Greek wines soon, I would definitely go for a region that it's called Nemea.
That's the only one I've heard of.
It's beginning of Peloponnese. Actually, we were there like a couple of weeks ago. We buy 20 bottles of wine.
Well, that's what you do.
I mean, we went to producers directly, and that's where you kind of try the wines, and it was really, really a good experience. And we tried actually a Gewürztraminer from Greece.
That's very new to me.
Crazy thing, because at the end, of course, the soil is different, the region is different, so it was very, very, very dry variation of what you would expect of a Gewürztraminer. And really, really good quality from a producer called Barafakas.
There you go.
In the mail. So
this is his turn to plug producers.
Really, really nice. Yeah.
No, and also I've got to say, like in my answer, there's an inherent bias for French wines, and that's what happens if you're French, that you tend to focus on French wines. And one of the things I learned after coming to Berlin was, you know, I discovered Slovenian wine, Austrian wine, and
I mean, I have my favorite Catalan wines and Spanish wines, of course, but it's not something that I can access easily right now. Like, I've been 7 years outside of my hometown. So at the end, I'm just like drinking that when I go to visit my parents.
No, obviously, yeah. No, but the whole sort of, if you Catalan wine, I'm sure, is such a huge rabbit hole in itself. And so for me, you know, I'm right now working through sort of a Languedoc, a Côte d'Huron, and I'm starting to enjoy Bordeaux, which is why we're drinking Bordeaux. I didn't used to enjoy Bordeaux, or it didn't appeal to me too much until I visited a chateau in the Graves area. And now there's so many other regions, so we tend to focus on that. And then everything else, I'm just sort of, I'm happy to have someone explain it to me. But perhaps I cannot really gain a lot of knowledge on that yet. I need to build up my knowledge about French and maybe Northern Italian wines, and that's the focus for now.
Nice. So to close the episode, favorite dish? Favorite dessert and favorite wine.
Yeah, so this is going to be very sort of in the now, right?
Of course, like everything is in the now in this episode. Like
everything's in the
probably
now.
In 4 years, your recipes are already in your website. There is Napoli's food in there, and you already explored different things.
Okay. So if we're talking about in the now, I'll do an entrée plat dessert. And a wine, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, So this is very much now. This is not my all-time favorite. I would start with a very simple dish, which is les œufs mayonnaise, or œuf mayonnaise, which is just, it's a very simple dish with eggs and mayonnaise. It's simple, but I love it. It's very, I love this word in French, we call it regressive food. Okay. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I'm sure this exists in other languages too. Okay. So, So, les œufs mayonnaise for the starter.
Mm-hmm.
For the dish, now, this is very sort of hard to pick one simple thing. But if I absolutely had to, I would pick in the French approach, because in Italy you have primo, secondo, but let's forget that. It would be my signature dish, which is the risotto Vasquez. Mm-hmm. Simple to make, and it's hearty. It's got a lot of sort of the warmth of the warmth of southern food, and it's got risotto. I love the texture of risotto. Mm-hmm. Got that. Now, dessert, I'm not very dessert. But what I would do is I would replace the dessert, and I do this quite often in restaurants. If other people are taking dessert, I order a digestif. A digestivo.
Oh, shit. We missed the whole digestive part.
Yeah, that's why I brought it back. So I would order a digestive instead of a dessert. Although I do, there are some desserts I really enjoy, but I'm not really a dessert person. So I would get a digestif, and this would either be, if I'm traveling, it has to be a local thing from mm-hmm. that region. So digestif is essentially...
Liquor.
Liquor, yeah, like a vegetable, often fruit.
Thingy.
Yeah. Like if I go to Denmark, it's aquavit. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to France, it could be something like a cognac, Armagnac, Chartreuse,
limoncello,
Averna, that sort mm-hmm. of thing. So I love this, and so that would be my entree, plat, and dessert.
Wine.
Oh, sorry, wine. Yes.
You can say wine region, if it covers better.
Languedoc. It would be a red from Languedoc. It's not, I know it's not very exciting, and people listening are probably going, yes, really, Languedoc is a very common region. I love, a Pissenlout or a very basic Languedoc with, the classic Syrah, Mourvèdre, Grenache, Sanso, that sort of, in some mix, right? I'm just, it's like my home, in music, you've got like the tonic of a scale, and that home note for me is the red Languedoc, so I'll go for that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Prima, for accepting a second episode, doing it in your place in Berlin.
Thank you so much for having me again.
I'm excited that we did this one finally in person and not online. I'm trying to reduce the episodes online, but yeah, thank you so much for the invitation and for accepting us.
Thank you so much for listening to me, because as some people might know, I'm never going to say no to you talking. It comes quite naturally to me. So thank you so much. And congratulations on the rebranding recently. It's very exciting. You asked me for some advice about the colors, and I'm glad you went for the color I picked. So I'm very, very happy with that.
You would be surprised, but you are not the only one who said that one. Like literally like 80% of the people was going for that color. So at the end, I thought that.
Yeah.
Why not? No.
Well, it's a lovely color, and so it's very exciting. Thanks to all your listeners as well,
exactly.
And do tell your friends about this podcast.
Yeah, thank you a lot to all of you who are listening. Thank you, Ambulance from Berlin, for destroying this outro. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the channels and follow us, and yeah, check Parimal websites and social media also.
I'm sure it'll be on the notes.
Maybe you will learn some recipes.
Hopefully. I've not gotten around to that, but I do hope to
It will arrive.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much as well. Bye.
Yeah.